Tonight is a continuation of what we did last week. Last week we looked at reasoning and the intellect, and tonight we'll look at first principles, conscience, first moral principles, and how we defend what we've been saying, how we defend our ability to know against relativism, against skeptics and relativists. Yeah. All right, so that's our theme. Okay, so last time we looked at reasoning, we looked at the intellect, and we saw that there were three operations of the mind: grasping concepts, making judgments, and then putting judgments together to make arguments, and we call that reasoning. And all reasoning, all of our sciences are built up by reasoning. All of philosophy comes through reasoning. All of our arts and technology comes through reasoning. And whenever we reason, we start with first principles, and then we draw a conclusion out of them that's really hidden in those principles. So we're not getting something totally new. We're getting something that's already there, that we already know, but we're making it explicit. We're pulling it out from what we already know. Now, when we reason for two purposes. And this goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle, reflecting on human reason, he saw that we reason for two ends, two purposes. One, simply to know the truth. And then the second, to act, to make things, to act in the world. And so he called the first kind of reasoning speculative or theoretical, when we reason simply to know the truth about things. And the second, practical. We reason in order to make things or to do things or to act in the world. Right? So we have speculative reasoning and practical reasoning. And we can divide the arts and sciences according to whether they're speculative or theoretical on the one hand, or practical on the other. So, for example, physics is speculative or theoretical. My dad was a theoretical physicist, and so his interest wasn't in practicality. No, you want to know how the universe is just for its own sake, to understand it. No, and that's how philosophy is too. A philosopher is interested in knowing the truth, metaphysics. We're interested in knowing the truth about reality, and especially about the first cause of reality, God, for God's sake. And theology too, right? Theology is first. A lot of us maybe think of theology as practical because it helps us get to heaven. That's true. But theology is first and foremost theoretical because it's about God. And it's good to contemplate God for who he is, for his sake. And then secondarily, we want to contemplate God so that we can be happy with him forever. Yeah. So theology is both theoretical and practical. But in any case, all of our reasoning is either theoretical or practical. And the theoretical, it has the primacy. It's more important. Because what will we be doing in heaven? Practical reason or theoretical reasoning? Well, we won't be reasoning. We'll be seeing God. We'll be contemplating God for eternity. And that's not practical. Right? That's practical is to help you get to the end. But when you're at the end, you contemplate the glory of God. Right? And so our goal, our end, heaven, is knowing the truth for its own sake. Now, we live in a culture that's very practical. And that's good, right? That's what makes us good at doing practical things. We're in a practical culture. But it has a danger, too. The danger is that Americans, we tend to think that what's not practical is useless. And therefore, what's theoretical, what's truth for its own sake, well, that's kind of a waste of time. And that's not right. That's... Because in order to think practically, you have to have a purpose. And therefore, there has to be a truth. It doesn't do any good to know how to do something until first you know that it's good to do it. And so we have to guide our practical reasoning by our theoretical. But in any case, both of them, the theoretical and the practical, have to be based in something that's a foundation. Right? So all of our reasoning starts with something we already know. And then on that, we build. That means that you can't... A lot of times people, especially if they're from the sciences, and you start to talk to them about philosophy, they say, well, prove that. And then you give another principle, and they say, prove that. And they want everything proved. And you can't do that. You can't prove everything. Because every argument's got to start from something that's ultimately not proven because you see it. It's self-evident. All reasoning comes from first principles that you can't prove. But that's not a problem, because you don't need to prove something that's evident. All right? And so we call those first principles. And they're self-evident. Self-evident means that as soon as you understand the terms, you see it's true. Unless you've been corrupted by studying bad philosophy, which happens as soon as you go off to college and start to study philosophy. But everybody, so let's take an example. Something can't be and not be in the same way at the same time. Can't be and not be. That's a contradiction. And everybody knows it, except the philosophers. Or, everything we do in our daily life presupposes that something can't be and not be in the same way at the same time. It can't be good for me and bad for me in the same way at the same time. Maybe it's good in one way, bad in another way. Good at one time, bad at another time. But it can't be good and bad in the same way at the same time. It can't be true and false in the same way at the same time. It can't be and not be in the same way at the same time. And that's the very first principle of all. And everybody knows it, and you don't need to prove it. And if somebody says, prove that to me, don't bother. You see it. And if you want me to prove that, then you're playing a game, ultimately. Because you know it, because you act on it. Right? We wouldn't... if it was just the same to get in a car accident or not to get into a car accident, if it were just the same to get run over or not to get run over, right? So everybody knows it. And that principle is so self-evident because all you have to know is one idea, be. That to be is different than not be. And so that's the first notion of the human mind, to be. Maybe it's not the first word, but it's the first idea, because when a baby grasps milk, or mama, the baby knows that mama is different than not mama. Very different. And that milk is different than not milk, etc. And so this is the very first principle. All right. And then there's another principle that we all know, that everything that changes has to have a cause. Every effect has a cause. Everybody knows it, except some philosophers. Or, everyone who acts for some purpose. Maybe it's a crazy purpose, maybe they're thinking totally wrongly, but they're acting for some reason. Every agent acts for some end. Otherwise, they wouldn't do anything. Or, even simpler, the whole is greater than the part. Right? Everybody knows it. And you don't need to prove it. It would be ridiculous, no, to prove to someone that the whole is bigger than the part. Right? That'd be crazy. Or this, the human mind can know reality. A lot of philosophers doubt it. But think of that. How crazy that would be, to doubt that we can know reality and to dedicate your life to philosophy. Or this, truth exists. Right? We all know that truth exists. Except maybe when we're in philosophy class at the blackboard. But even the philosopher, we'll get to this at the end, even the philosopher says there is no truth, and he writes it down. Does he think that's true or false? Right? He thinks it's true. Well, here's another first principle. The world is not absurd. We all know this, and we all act on the basis the world is not absurd. Except, again, the philosopher. There's a whole school of philosophy, existentialism, that basically thinks that life and the world is absurd. And ultimately, you can't, I mean, it's pointless to enter into a discussion with them, because that's a first principle. It's part of sanity. We'll come back to this at the end. All right, well, Hollywood may be absurd. The way people live may be very absurd. But that's the sign that we're not living right. Right? It wakes us up to reality. We can put ourselves in all kinds of absurd situations, but we're in contradiction with nature when we do it. And therefore, the world's not absurd. Maybe my life is absurd, the way I'm living it, but it's not meant to be absurd. Okay. Ultimately, that's a first principle. Those are theoretical principles. Let's look at practical principles. Here, too, there are first. And of all of those theoretical principles, there's one of them that's the first. And that was the first one we mentioned. Something can't be and not be at the same way at the same time. Because the only thing you have to grasp is be. The very first idea. And it's the same way with practical principles. There's a very first one, and all you have to understand is good. What does it mean for something to be good? The good is to be sought, and evil avoided. Everyone who knows the meaning of the word good knows that good is to be sought and evil avoided. We may be very mistaken on what is good and what is evil, but at least we know good is to be sought, evil avoided. Right? And everyone knows it. There's not a single person on the planet who doesn't know it. Right? And even the child knows it. But again, he won't know fully what's the good, but he knows good is to be sought. Okay, from this, every other practical principle follows. So if good is to be done and evil avoided, well, who's good? Just my good? But I see that my neighbor is another me, right? My neighbor is another self. So if I know that good is to be sought for me, and my neighbor is another self, well, clearly, good needs to be sought for my neighbor as for myself. And everyone knows that who knows that his neighbor is another person. All we need to know is that my neighbor is a person, and I know I have to seek good for my neighbor as for myself. Right? In other words, all we have to see is that we're all human beings, and therefore we're all persons, and therefore good is to be sought for each one as for myself. And even the worst person on the face of the earth knows that principle, and they use it. They use it in some things. They limit it, but they use it at least in some things. Because they'll be very upset if the worst person, right, the worst criminal, will be incredibly upset if his neighbor, say another member of a criminal gang, doesn't treat him as he would treat himself. Right? In other words, if I see that my fellow gang member is not treating me as he would treat himself, well, then I'm justifiably irate with him. Right? So everybody knows it. And the same thing goes for this. The common good is to be preferred to the private good. And this follows from the fact that the whole is greater than the part, right? We all know that was one of our speculative principles, theoretical principles. The whole is greater than the part. Okay, good is to be sought. Therefore, the good of the whole is to be sought more than the good of the part. Right? The good of the whole community is more than my private good. The good of the whole society is more than my private good. The good of the whole universe is more than my private good. Right? The good of the church is more than my private good. And again, even the the worst thief or criminal in his gang, suppose he catches somebody stealing from the common purse of the gang and storing it away for his own private, he'll kill him. Right? Because he recognizes he's violating this first moral principle. Right? They're all robbing from everybody else. But if somebody prefers their private good to the good of our gang, he's dead man. Right? So even a criminal knows that the common good is to refer to the private good, but he doesn't apply it. Right? He only applies it selectively. Another obvious principle: give to each one their due. All you have to understand to grasp that is what is meant by due. Now, we may be very mistaken about what is due to somebody, but everybody knows that you have to give them what's theirs. Right? To give each one what is theirs, what is due to them. Right? That's the principle of justice. And there's not a single person that doesn't know it. Again, in the robber gang, they also apply that. Right? You have to give to each one in the gang what is theirs. And then, once you know that there's a God, it's obvious, it's self-evident, that God has to be loved and obeyed above all. Because he's the maker of all, right? If there's a maker of all, well then he has to be loved and obeyed above all. Because everything, if there's a creator, comes from him. Right? So everybody knows that if there's a God, he has to be loved and obeyed above all. And even the atheist knows this. And that's maybe precisely why the atheist says there is none. Because he doesn't want to love someone above all things. And this came out very clearly in a debate that was we had at Powell Hall a couple years ago. There was a famous atheist, I think it was Christopher Hitchens, debating a theist, Dinesh D'Souza. And in the course of the debate, the atheist, Hitchens, it turns out that his principal reason, or at least the principal reason that he gave in this debate for being an atheist, is if there's a God, I would have to grovel. Therefore, there is no God. Right? That's what it came down to. It was evident to everyone in the audience, I think. Because it wasn't whether there is, he didn't care about the reasons. It's why do you want to believe that? I don't want to believe that, basically, is what he was saying. Because he recognized this principle. If there's a God, you're going to have to obey him above all things. And you're going to have to love him, because he's the source of your being. Right? And so God is to be loved above all, and our neighbor is to be not simply treated as we would want to be treated, but to be loved as we want to be loved. Right? So the double commandment of love, to love God above all things and our neighbor as ourselves, they're first principles. And that means that everybody ultimately knows them, even when we violate them so terribly. Okay? So a first principle is something that someone can't not know once they understand the terms. Maybe an infant doesn't know them because he doesn't understand the words yet. But as soon as you take a three-year-old and you start to explain a little about God, he'll understand. God is to be obeyed, and God is to be loved above all. Right? Even the three- and four-year-old. Right? So those are first principles. And everything else in morality comes out of them. Right? So all of morality is implicit in those first principles. For example, good is to be sought, evil avoided, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. From those two principles, we get all the Ten Commandments, basically. So the first three commandments come from God is to be loved above all, and God is, give to each one their due, give to God his due. Right? What's due to God? Well, obedience, worship, fidelity, and service. In other words, worship. And that requires time. And so I have to give him time. I have to sanctify time, part of time, for God. And that was the glory in Israel of the Sabbath. Right? The commandment of the Sabbath, the third commandment, was the commandment to set aside time for God, because it's due to God that we have a relationship with Him, and that we recognize that He's above all our mundane concerns. And so that's the reason for Sunday. And then the other commandments, especially the fifth through the tenth commandment, come from simply seeing the fundamental goods. For example, everybody knows that life is a good because we want to preserve our life by nature. And so we know that life is a good, and therefore, using the golden rule, my life is a good, therefore my neighbor's life is a good. Thou shalt not kill. And then we recognize that family, and especially marital fidelity, is a tremendous good. And therefore, apply the golden rule, thou shalt not commit adultery. And we recognize property as a great good, because through property we can take care of our family. And hence, thou shalt not steal. The golden rule. And the same thing goes for the ninth and tenth commandments, simply with regard to thoughts. Right? So all the Ten Commandments come right out of these first moral principles. And so nobody can ultimately not know them. We may not act on them. And that's why our conscience bothers us. Now, there's a fancy philosophical name for these first principles, first moral principles. The word is synderesis. Yeah. But it's enough just to say first moral principles, and everybody understands. And so conscience is rooted in first moral principles. And these first moral principles are ultimately indestructible in people. Right? Even the worst sinner still knows the golden rule, and it bothers them. Right? And that's why the sinner can't sleep well. The greatest illustration of this is Shakespeare's Macbeth. Lady Macbeth, who led her husband into all of these unbelievable crimes, most terrible crimes of ingratitude and treason. Well, she couldn't sleep. She saw blood everywhere. And she tried to wipe out the blood that wasn't there. Out, spot of blood. Yeah. So, and even in hell, are there still first moral principles? Yes. The damned would wish that there weren't, I suppose. But it's precisely the fact that they recognize those first moral principles, even in hell, that is the principal punishment of hell. Like, that's what makes hell so bad, ultimately, is that they're in contradiction. Everyone who's in hell is in eternal contradiction with themselves. Right? So they can't be destroyed, but they can be dimmed. Right? We dim them by making a habit of sin. All right, so let's look now at conscience. And by the way, that's a great gift of God, that these first moral principles are indestructible. Right? That's what makes conversion possible. And it's the foundation of human dignity. Right? Even in the worst sinner, they've still got something good. And something very good that we can appeal to always. Okay, so what's conscience? So we use the word in different ways, but in essence, conscience is a judgment. It's a judgment that we make about whether our acts are good or bad. Right? So it's a judgment, a practical judgment, about the moral value of our own acts. Present, past, or future. Right? That's the act of conscience. Right? So we could say a fancy term would be a dictate of reason. That's the same as to say a judgment. A judgment, and last week somebody asked the question, but Jesus says we're not to judge. But he's not talking about this kind of judgment. This is the judgment that we must do, right? We must judge our own acts, whether they're right or wrong. Right? Before we act, we better judge them. Otherwise, we'll sin. Okay. So the Catechism defines conscience, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, as a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act that he's going to perform, is performing, or has already completed. Right? Past, present, or future. And it refers to our acts, conscience. Right? It doesn't refer to our neighbor's acts, conscience. Right? And the root of the word conscience, you can see there's the word science in conscience. And the con comes from the Latin with. It's acting with science. In other words, acting with knowledge about the morality of what we're doing. That's conscience. In other words, it's when we're acting, conscience is the knowledge of the good or evil of what we're doing. And everybody has conscience who knows first principles. And that's everyone. Everyone, we say, who gets to the age of reason, which is an imprecise thing, but obviously there are grades. And so conscience, it's in everyone, and what it does is it judges our acts, and if we've already done the act, it reproves us or lauds us, depending on whether we've acted well or ill. And so our conscience can reassure us or accuse us. And it accuses us also in the present with regard to what we're thinking of doing and what we're planning to do in the future. And ultimately, when we make a decision that has moral implications, now when we make a decision in which our conscience is speaking to us, the voice of conscience ultimately speaks to us with the voice of God. In other words, conscience is that place in us where God speaks to us. Because these first principles, right, the golden rule, we didn't make them. Right? We know that they're true, but we also know that it wasn't me who wrote up that principle, the golden rule, but that it was my maker who made that rule. Right? Because we know that we don't have the power to cancel that rule. Right? I can't say, well, this is very inconvenient for me that to give each one their due, or say not to steal. And I can't simply, well, I don't want this to apply, so it's not going to apply. Right? Because conscience recognizes that this applies whether I want it to or not. And that's precisely why we hear it not as our voice, but as the voice of our maker. Right? So when conscience speaks to us, who's speaking? God is really speaking. And therefore, if we disobey conscience, who are we disobeying? God. And that's true even if our conscience is mistaken in some way. Because it's still coming to us, we'll talk more about that in a minute, as the voice of God. So even the person who has some mistake in conscience, take an example. Someone thinks that something is the true religion, which isn't the true religion. For example, Islam. And he thinks that, as a devout Muslim, he has an obligation to do something, which he really doesn't, because it's not the true religion. And therefore, that obligation doesn't really exist. For example, to fast during Ramadan. But he thinks that it does, because he thinks that Islam is a true religion. And therefore, if he thinks that Islam is a true religion, and he doesn't fast in Ramadan, what is he doing? He's sinning. He would do better to fast. But he would do still better to look into the Catholic Church. The Second Vatican Council has a beautiful section on conscience. It's in the pastoral constitution, Gaudium et Spes, which means joy and hope. And it's speaking about the problems in the modern world and the church's effort to speak to the modern world. And one of the issues that the document treats is modern atheism. But before it treats atheism, it treats conscience. And it's a beautiful section. It says, bless you. In the depths of his conscience, man detects a law which he does not impose upon himself, but which holds him to obedience. Right? That's the key. It's a law. I didn't make the law. You didn't make the law. But it holds all of us to obedience. Always summoning him to love good and avoid evil. Always. Right? Because that's the first principle of conscience. Good is to be done, evil avoided. The voice of conscience, when necessary, speaks to his heart, do this, shun that. For man has in his heart a law written by God. Right? Who's the author of these first moral principles? God, because he's the author of our nature. And these things we naturally know. Right? So God's the author of them. Man has in his heart a law written by God. To obey it is the very dignity of man. According to it, he will be judged. Right? Each one. Conscience is the most secret core and sanctuary. Sanctuary because it's holy, conscience. It's holy in every human being because it's where God speaks to us. Right? It's the interior temple, we could say, or sanctuary. There he is alone with God, everyone, even Lady Macbeth, even Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin. There he is alone with God, whose voice echoes in his depths, whether we like it or not. In a wonderful manner, conscience reveals that law which is fulfilled by love of God and neighbor. Right? That's the first thing that conscience tells us, is God is to be loved above all, and our neighbors ourselves. In fidelity to conscience, Christians are joined with the rest of men in the search for truth. This is so beautiful about conscience that everyone has it. It's absolutely universal. It transcends every border of culture, race, language, religion. It's universal. Christians are joined with the rest of men in the search for truth and for the genuine solution to the numerous problems which arise in the life of individuals and social relations. Hence, the more right conscience holds sway, the more persons and groups turn from blind choice and strive to be guided by objective norms of morality. And so in every country, we serve the common good by working for conscience and the rights of conscience and strengthening the formation of conscience. Right? This is the principal task of Catholics, lay people, in the temporal world, right? In the social order, in the political order, in the economic order. Right? Wherever profession we find ourselves, we should be working for this, right? To strengthen conscience in those people that we come into contact with, and above all, in ourselves. Now, conscience frequently errs. No, it's true that frequently conscience errs from an invincible ignorance without losing its dignity. Right? So the person, for example, who believes in a religion that's really not true, but if they do so out of invincible ignorance, then following it is central to human dignity. Right? And this is the key to religious liberty. Right? If any government that crushes religious expression is ultimately forcing people to act against their conscience in what's most important in life. And that's why the church insists so much on freedom of religion, religious liberty, as, after the right to life, the key to human rights. Because it's the guarantee of all the others, ultimately. So a person is when someone, when conscience errs because of invincible ignorance, it doesn't lose its dignity. Now, the same, unfortunately, cannot be said for a man who cares but little for truth and goodness, or for a conscience which, by degrees, grows practically sightless as a result of habitual sin. Now, this is what we call the deformation of conscience. The conscience gets deformed, above all, how? When we don't act according with it. Right? So if conscience tells me something, and I disregard it, and do the opposite, and then I do it again, and again, and again, and I form what we call a vice, what happens to conscience's voice? Well, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. It's always there, but it got dimmed by precisely my acting against conscience. And this is usually what happens when... an erring conscience is, above all, comes from the fact that we've acted habitually against conscience. Let's take a suicide bomber or someone who's involved in terrorism for religious purposes. A lot of times we say, well, he's acting in accordance with conscience. But is he? He knows the golden rule. And so if I'm doing something that's going to blow up innocent, say, children, I can't possibly think that that's morally right. It's impossible. Because I can't help but know the golden rule. Do unto others, you want them to do it unto you. And I don't want anybody to blow up my kids. And so I know that I ought not to do this. But the problem is, I've been inculcated or brainwashed, whatever, to think that it's good, but I know that it's not. And so ultimately, I'm in contradiction with what? With my own conscience. So my conscience is still rebelling against that. Right? Nobody could ever say that their conscience is making them do that kind of terrorist act. Right? That's not conscience. It's overriding conscience. Right? It's ideology overriding conscience. And that happens all the time. But conscience is still protesting. Right? That's what's so beautiful about conscience, is that it protests. And it's painful, right? The protest of conscience is perhaps the most painful thing in human life. But it's also, ultimately, the most beautiful. I had a beautiful experience. I was in Rome. You have to be careful about getting pickpocketed. We lived in Rome. And I knew all the rules. We lived there for 8 years. And I was walking near the Colosseum, and I knew that when you saw the gypsies coming out to you, hold on to your wallet. And so I was walking with my son, we were praying the rosary, and I saw these gypsy kids coming, and I knew that I had to hold on to my wallet, and especially when they have it selling newspapers, because what happens is there's a child hidden under this newspaper that they're trying to sell you, who's the one who's going to pick your pocket. And I knew it, but I went to get it. I was stupidly carrying my wallet in my coat pocket. I went to get it, and it was already gone. It was like that. And I never saw the kid who took it. But so at first I yelled at them, and then I reflected a minute. I was praying the rosary. Our Lady should help me with this. And so it just occurred to me at that time to take a different tack, to say to the kids who remained there strangely, you know, I've got a son too who's just your age, and it's hard for us too. And so this 4-year-old kid, or maybe 5-year-old or 6-year-old, something like that, he gave me back the wallet. And there was a picture of a lady on top, because that was in my coat pocket too. But anyway, what was so beautiful though is not that I got my wallet back, but that this kid had a conscience. Yeah. I mean, they were trained to do this, and probably he'd get beaten when he got home for not getting that wallet. But so it's universal experience, and we find it universally. No, and it's beautiful to see in Scripture, in the Bible, it's there from the beginning, and we see it in the very, obviously, with the original sin, the whole experience of conscience, that in the way that Eve's sin is described, and then God appearing to them, and we see, what do we see, Adam and Eve? Hiding. Why are they hiding? Because conscience made them ashamed of what they had done, and so they hid from God. And then we see, and even perhaps more clearly still, the experience of conscience in the second sin recorded in Scripture, of Cain. Right? So Cain and Abel. Cain is jealous because Abel's offering is accepted by God and Cain's offering isn't. And probably that's because Abel offered the best and he offered with his heart and Cain probably didn't offer the best. But in any case, Cain is angry and jealous of Abel. And so God speaks to him and says, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you don't do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. And so that's the experience of conscience. You know that you must do something, you must master it. You can master it, but you don't want to. And Cain didn't. But that's conscience because... And so Scripture gives us that as God speaking to him. And of course it is God speaking to him, but it's God speaking to all of us whenever conscience speaks to us. John Paul II frequently speaks about conscience in his books and in his all of his encyclicals, as precisely as the seat of human dignity, conscience, the root of it. Right? It's what makes us morally responsible. He has a beautiful book, Love and Responsibility. Right? Responsibility comes from conscience. And that's what enables us to love in the full sense. And so in one of his encyclicals, this is the encyclical on the Holy Spirit, Dominum et Vivificantem, he speaks about the Second Vatican Council and its teaching on conscience and the dignity of the human person. And he says, conscience is the main characteristic of the personal subject. It's what makes us persons, having a conscience. Man, in the depths of his conscience, man detects a law which he did not impose upon himself, but which holds him to obedience. That's Vatican II. And so the conscience isn't something independent. It's not something autonomous. It's God's voice. And it's a principle of obedience with regard to objective norms that come from our nature and thus from the author of our nature, who's God. Right? And that's why we say that God's voice echoes in that sanctuary of conscience. And it's the voice of God, even in an atheist, right? An atheist who doesn't recognize the existence of God, he still grasps the dictate of conscience as binding him. Right? There are atheists who have great respect for conscience. And obviously that voice of conscience is coming from God also in the atheist. But the atheist doesn't recognize, that it's God speaking in that way. So the conscience is the voice of God, even when we don't recognize it to be anything more than the principle of the moral order. But it's ultimately... recognizing that God is the foundation of conscience gives so much greater strength to conscience. And I think everyone who's gone through a process of conversion has experienced that in themselves. And so I lived as an atheist for 29 years. As an atheist, I recognized conscience. But how much greater force conscience was given once I saw that there's a God who made me and loves me. That gives to conscience a foundation. Right? It's not that I didn't have it, but it becomes so much stronger. And that's why any society that tries to exclude God from the public square, like ours, what's going to happen? Conscience will be the first to suffer. And thus, removing God from the public square will go against the common good of any society. Because conscience is the greatest common good of every society. Right? The recognition of those fundamental moral principles. That's what makes life in society good is when our neighbor recognizes those, and we do too. And so stripping God from the public square will weaken gradually more and more those first principles. It won't happen overnight. But. Sure, that's what causes the decline of civilizations, right? Why do civilizations fall? Ultimately, because society gets secularized, and those first moral principles, they're always there, we always recognize them, but they lose their force in human affairs. Right? That's what, it's clear, I think, that that's what caused the fall of Rome. Yeah. And we won't be immune, right? If we choose to go down that path. Okay, let's shift a little bit now, and let's defend what we've said against those who attack it. And this isn't only our society, but it's a universal thing. That everywhere, all through history, whenever you look at history, you'll see that there's always a temptation of the mind to deny these gifts, the gift of intellect and the gift of first principles and the gift of conscience. Right? And today it goes by the name of relativism. And that was one of the great lines of Benedict before he was made Pope, speaking about the dictatorship of relativism. But it's, again, it's not just our society. And this is you can see this very strongly by reading Plato. So back in 500 BC, you could see that in the society of Athens, the majority of philosophers were simply doing philosophy to get paid and for personal advantage, for the personal advantage of the person who hired them. They were basically that the philosophers those days, they called them sophists, were people who were paid to make whatever argument their client wanted them to make. And Plato was, well, first Socrates and Plato, and then Aristotle, were so, their nobility, the reason why they're so great, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, is that they were the greatest opponents, and I think in world history, against that kind of view of philosophy. Right? Socrates, his whole life was a battle against these sophists. And therefore, his whole life was a defense that there are first principles, and that there's an objective morality, and that there's an objective truth about God, man, and the world. And so back in 500 BC, there were relativists, and they were the majority. And so we ought not to be surprised that it's the same in 2010. And so we call it, in general, it's skepticism. Skepticism has many different forms. Skepticism is the idea that, how do we know that we know these things? And since I don't know, I'm just going to doubt everything. And it comes up in every century. And it even in the height of Catholic culture in the 13th and 14th centuries, skepticism spread very widely. And it took a particular form called nominalism. So in the 13th century, you had the greatest philosophers of all time, greatest philosophers and theologians, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Bonaventure, St. Albert. And right after, a generation after, a kind of Catholic skepticism, a Catholic relativism began to spread more and more. And it destroyed that synthesis and ultimately led to the Reformation. Because Luther was schooled in that kind of nominalist philosophy. All right, so I'm going to have to bear with me a minute as I explain what nominalism is. Nominalism is the idea that universal concepts like cow, pig, truth, beauty are just names. They're just names that are convenient classes in which we stick a whole bunch of individuals. But there really isn't anything such as human nature. They're just human beings that more or less have things in common, and so we give them one name, human beings, as a matter of convenience. And likewise, they're, all of these very different things that we call dogs because it's convenient, and others that we call cows, and other things that we call maybe truth or beauty or goodness, but there really aren't any essences out there. And it's just a convenient thing for the human mind. And so we really don't know what we think that we know. Now, that's ridiculous. But this is what happens in philosophy. Philosophers come up with this idea that the common man knows that's ridiculous. But it's the philosopher who falls into these because... why does that happen? Well, the reason why the common man knows it is because common sense really is common. because we have human nature. We all share human nature, and therefore, by sharing human nature, we all know these same first principles. And therefore, it's truly common sense. And that's why the good philosophy... How do you tell a good philosophy from bad philosophy? Good philosophy is in harmony with common sense and takes it further. Bad philosophy says it's above common sense. And that common sense that the masses have, well, that's just self-delusion. And so bad philosophy is kind of elitism. It's saying we're above this common sense for the masses, which is self-delusion. And we're the ones who truly know that common sense isn't, the opposite of it is true. All right, so how do you judge a philosophy? The true philosophy is the one that's in profound harmony with common sense. Because that's what all of us have got to go by. Right? That's the only thing we've got to go by. And therefore, how do we show that a philosophy is bad? It contradicts common sense in this sense of what's truly common to all. The golden rule, that's common to everyone. Non-contradiction, something can be and not be in the same way at the same time. The primacy of the common good over the private good. These are common in the true sense of the word. And therefore, any philosophy that says the opposite, by that very fact, is judged to be false. Right? So in physics, we judge something to be false because it goes against our experiments. Right? So if I put forth a theory and the experiments show that, well, reality is telling me the opposite. But the same thing happens in philosophy. Philosophy, too, has a kind of tribunal. It's not the experiment, it's not the telescope. It's common sense grasp of first principles. Right? We're the tribunal. Right? So how do we argue against this nominalism? It's against common sense. All of us know that we can know what a pig is. And that there really are pigs. And that there's a class of things called pigs. And every pig has pigness, and every non-pig doesn't. Right? In the same way, if you want or not. Every cat has some kind of catness. They can be very different. But we see, we know this because we can see all different kinds of cats, and they can be all look very different. And we know that they're all cats. Like, this is so obvious. But, I mean, that's what you have to do in philosophy classes, defend the obvious. We have this capacity given to us by human nature to grasp that all of these things that look different, maybe smell different, act different, they're all cats. Because we've got the universal. We grasp the universal cat, and we're not bound that this cat looks different than that. And I mentioned last week that there was a guy who was training his dog. And this was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. And this guy had trained his dog, spending 5 hours a day for 4 or 5 years, to recognize 2,000 different commands. So this dog had a vocabulary of 2,000 words. But they were all proper nouns. There was no universal among them. And so you could tell the dog to get this doll, doll A, doll B, doll C, doll D, doll E. But the dog doesn't know doll. All he knows is doll A, B, C. Right? Whereas we grasp the universal. And so the nominalist, what is he doing? He's thinking that we're dogs. Right? The nominalist is saying we don't know, there's no such thing as dog. All there are individuals. There's dog A, there's dog B, there's dog C. Well, that's how this guy's dog knew. In other words, nominalism is basically saying that our knowing capacity is better by degree, but not essentially better than a chimp or a dog. Right? And we all know that that's wrong. And furthermore, it doesn't make any sense, because if you say, all right, There is no such thing as dogness. There's just dog A, dog B, dog C. Well, why do we use one word dog for them all? Well, they say, well, dogs are more similar to one another than dogs are to cats. All right, and that's true. But what makes them similar? Well, they're sharing something in common, right? They wouldn't be similar if they didn't have something in common. Well, what do they have in common? Dogness. Well, there we go. Okay, this is important, because if you say there are no natures and we can't know any natures, then that would mean we couldn't know human nature. If we can't know human nature, then I can't separate, say, a human being from a chimp. And so killing a human being wouldn't ultimately be so different from killing a chimp. But we all know that that's abominable, because we all grasp that there's such a thing as human nature, and we all know that every human being has it, and no chimp has it. Right? So it's the errors that we make in philosophy class can cause destruction of societies. Okay. Now, this nominalism, this idea that we can't know universals, has had a huge influence on the modern world. Huge. Tremendous. All the major philosophers of modern times, from 1500 till the present, have been mostly nominalists, unless they've been Catholic philosophers. And so all the famous names that people study in college, Descartes, Locke, Hume, Kant, all of them are nominalists. That means that they all think that there aren't any natures out there, and we can't know any natures, and that the world is really, if there aren't any natures, it's just a chaos. And if the world is just a chaos, well, why do we see it as orderly? Where does the source of order come from? That's a good question. If it's just a chaos out there, if there aren't natures, that will mean that the source of order comes not from God, who made those natures, because there aren't any, but from my mind that imposes an order on the world. And this, we call this school of philosophy idealism. Idealism is the idea that, what do we know? Not reality, because reality is a chaos and unknowable. What we know is the idea that we impose. And the most famous philosopher who did this, his name was Kant, Immanuel Kant, and he's very difficult to read. And people go to college and they study philosophy, and they maybe invest a tremendous amount of effort, and they can't understand any of it, and it's better, because if you could understand it, what do you come away with? We can't know reality. All we can know is what the mind projects on reality. And so somebody might ask, well, how is it, if reality is a chaos and we can't know reality, how is it that we can talk about reality? Right? Because I think we can agree that there's a table there. But Kant would say that even space and time come from the human mind. There is no such thing as space and time in reality. So dimension, that this is, 18 inches long. That's my mind imposing that on reality. All right. So how can we all get together and talk about this table or these? Well, it's because we're all projecting the same thing. We've conveniently got the same projectors. It's like the world's a movie, and we're all projectors, but we're projecting the same world. And so we can talk about this world, but we can't talk about the reality of it because we're not entitled to know that that's real or not. Right? This is crazy. But the thing is, you have to spend so much effort to even master what he's saying that once you spend all that effort, you're not going to be willing to say, this is crazy. Right? It's the emperor's new clothes. If you spent a fortune to get a degree and learn maybe German to read Kant, although it's probably easier in English, you're not going to want to say that the emperor, is naked. Yeah. But anyway, this is a huge problem because so much of our culture is based on this. Think of the concept. If the mind is imposing all of this on reality, what are you going to... You can see what's going to come from this. Kant wasn't a relativist. He wasn't. He believed in an objective morality because he believed that everyone's mind projected what he called the categorical imperative. Always act in such a way that you treat another as an end and not as a means. And he believed that that was true, even though we can't know anything about reality. And so Kant was still defending an objective morality. But you see what's going to happen. If we're projecting reality, everybody's going to see that we're projecting morality. Right? If we project reality, morality won't be any different. And if I'm projecting morality, and you're projecting it differently, and somebody else, who am I to say that my projection of morality is better than yours? And so you're going to end up, if you're an idealist, almost, I would say, inevitably, even though Kant tried not to, he was noble, he tried not to, but idealism leads to moral relativism. We project the world, we project morality, and therefore different cultures will project it differently. And who am I to say that the, I don't know, Aztec culture was projecting morality badly? Maybe I don't personally like it, but how can I say that my morality is better than theirs? But if we think about that, and I think we're all to a large degree affected by this in our culture today. Right? That's my truth, and that's your truth, and who might impose my view? But think about it. This Aztec culture that we're talking about, I mean, they were sacrificing babies and children and teenagers to a god like Baal in tremendous numbers. One in five of the youths of Mexico had their living hearts ripped out from their chests while they're still alive, to be fed to this god, and then the bodies were kicked down these huge pyramids, and then they cooked them and ate their thighs and, I don't know, the priests. And we're not going to say that, well, that's just their culture projecting morality in a certain way. Right? We all know that's abominable. And why do we know it? Because we've got first moral principles. Golden rule. I don't want to have my living heart ripped out and have my body push down this thing slithering and then be cooked into pork chops. And so I can't do it to my neighbor. All right. Now, Kant, everybody who studies philosophy has to study Kant. But we've left Kant behind because Kant still believed in a universal morality. And so we today think of our, not hopefully anyone here, but our culture thinks of itself, at least in the more intellectually fashionable circles, as postmodern. We've left this modern, Kant would be kind of modernism, this idea of a universal project of morality, even though you've gotten rid of reality. And postmodernism is leaving that behind. Postmodernism is the idea that there is no truth, that everything is, they like to say, contextual. Everything is contained. Everything is determined by the context. Everything is determined by the culture. Everything is determined by history. And so this affects all of our culture in many ways. For example, even things like art and architecture. Postmodernism in architecture is, well, it's just, architecture is just a kind of game playing with forms. And so I'm going to play with 18th century forms, I'm going to play with 17th century forms, I'm going to play with Gothic forms, and I'm going to mix them together and play. But there is no objective beauty. There's no reason to use one style more than another. It's just play. And that's bad in art, but it's worse when it comes to ethics. Right? And when it comes to social policy, when it comes to religion. Right? With regard to religion, it immediately leads to religious indifferentism. There is no truth. They're just these different forms, and we can play with them why would we take one rather than another? Well, sentiment. I like this better. This makes me feel better. Right? This gives me some kind of high. This happens all the time when we talk about religion with other people. Well, if it helps you get through life, I'm all for it. If it helps you wake up in the morning and go to bed at night, as if that was all that it was, right? They're taking for granted that there is no truth. And it's just practical. And this is a very American kind of thing. There was the American version of relativism was people like John Dewey, and the idea was cash value. The key thing is the cash value of our ideas. I'll come back to this in a minute. And so if it helps you get through life, Okay. We all say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And that's not good if you're an artist. Yeah. Right? Because somebody says, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, I made this masterpiece. Well, if beauty is in the eye of the beholder, somebody else can say, well, that's the worst thing ever done. Right? We don't want to say that Michelangelo's David is simply a beauty in the eye of the beholder. Right? There's something objective about that. But we go right from that beauty is in the eye of the beholder to truth is in the eye of the beholder. Now, the reason why we say sometimes beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because an eye has to be formed. There's some truth in it, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Because if my eye is not formed, and I look at Michelangelo, and I don't know anything about art at all, well, maybe I'll like this piece of kitsch better than Michelangelo. It could happen. Because my eye is unformed. And so the eye needs support. It's like wine tasting. I don't know anything about wine, and so nobody should ask me what's the good wine and from the bad wine. But if you want to know what's a good wine, you go to somebody who has formed palate, right? Who knows wines. And they'll tell you what's a good wine and what's a bad wine. Right? Nobody would think that anybody should be... You can't just let anybody judge, say, what's the good wine, or you'll waste your money. Well, if that's true about things like wines and it's true about beauty, well, it's also true much more about truth. Right? Truth is objective, but if the mind's not formed, what's going to happen? We won't get to it. Right? And that's why formation is so important. That's why we're doing this tonight, or other similar things. But anyway, postmodernism is the idea that, well, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, truth is in the eye of the beholder. Right? There are no objective standards of truth or value. Right? There's just the value that we want to give to things. Right? And that's really how do we justify abortion in our country? Well, we don't want to give to that person a value. Right? As if it was up to us to give the value or not. As if it weren't something objective. Thou shalt not kill a human being. An innocent human being. Okay, how do we respond to this? Well, I think we've already done it. Everybody knows that we can grasp the truth of things. Right? Everybody knows it. So how do you refute a skeptic? The first and easiest way to refute a skeptic is every skeptic, every relativist, contradicts himself. Everyone. It's guaranteed. There's no exception to this. So let's take some different examples. Somebody says, there is no truth. All right. Are you putting forth that as a truth or not? So right there, he's contradicted himself. He says there is no truth, except one, really. There's only one truth, that there is no truth. Or even if he says, he's more modest, he says, okay, I don't know that there's truth or not truth. All I know is that I don't know the truth. All right, do you know that or not? He's putting it forth as if he knows it. So he knows one truth, that he doesn't know the truth. That's a good start. Right, so he's not a total skeptic. Right? The only way for a skeptic to not get caught up in contradiction is to never open his mouth. That's it. And Aristotle said this back in the 4th century BC. He says, somebody who denies the principle of non-contradiction, there's no point in talking with him because he's worse than a dog. Not morally, but intellectually. Because at least the dog knows the difference from his dog food and non-dog food. Right? The dog knows the difference between what's dangerous and what's not, between his master and what's not, etc. And so the skeptic ultimately makes himself like a rock. And so you can't talk to him. Because if he's willing to say anything, already he's not a skeptic. Because he thinks that what he says is different than the opposite. Right? All of human speech implies that what I'm saying is different than the opposite of what I'm saying. But a person who denies non-contradiction thinks it doesn't matter. Actually, you can't even... So But the fact is that they're speaking all day long, right? They're speaking all day long and insisting that their system is true. Right? So here we have a great truth. Our capacity to know the truth is so true that nobody can deny it without immediately contradicting themselves. Okay, let's look at some other forms. So people say, okay, there's my truth and there's your truth. Everyone has their own truth. What should we say about that? Well, what do you mean? Are you saying that that's true in general? That each one of us has our own truth? Well, if that's true in general, then it's not your truth or my truth. Right? No one who says, there's my truth and there's your truth, thinks that that is just my truth. Right? Everybody says that there's my truth and there's your truth. The reason why they're saying that is they want universal tolerance. They don't want... They want to be able to hold whatever they want, basically. And so they don't think that my truth can exist if my truth involves objective reality. Right? If my truth is, let's take an example. If my truth is that God's revelation about morality is true, and therefore, let's take an example, homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. That's true, not just for me, right? We all have to hold that that's true in general. Or killing babies is bad universally. And so somebody who says, there's my truth and there's your truth, they're not allowing for that. They're denying that there's an objective morality. All right, whose truth is that? Do you see? They've immediately contradicted themselves. Because they're saying, as a universal principle, binding on everyone, no one's allowed to judge anybody else. In other words, they're saying that there's one thing that's universally wrong, judging. And therefore, they're not saying that's only my truth. It's my truth that I can't judge, but you're perfectly welcome to judge me. Right? Nobody would say that. And nor will they say, and if I, let's take this even further. There's my truth and there's your truth. All right. If it's your truth that it's fine to kill me, I'm going to say that's okay. You can have your truth? Of course not, because I recognize, obviously, that you've got to apply the golden rule when you deal with me. Right? So nobody really believes this. We say it all the time, there's my truth and your truth. No one believes it in reality. And if they say it, they're contradicting themselves. Okay, another thing that we encounter frequently is the idea of historical relativism. Everybody, every culture has its own worldview, and every culture just simply judges according to their worldview. In other words, we're determined by our culture. And this was the essence of Marxism. It came from Hegel. Hegel had the idea that every period had the zeitgeist, the spirit of its own times, and you couldn't help but understand things according to the spirit of the times, and that was what the good in philosophy was to act in accordance with the spirit of these times, and not, in other words, the goodness, according to Hegel, is to be with the times. To be, or even better, to be avant-garde, to be a little bit ahead of the times. And so he would see people like Napoleon as being great because they were ahead of the times. But then, okay, that's contradictory. Does everybody see how that's contradictory? Because you're putting forth a theory of cultural relativism. That theory, do you think it's absolutely true? Or is it true only in your particular society at that particular moment that you're saying it? Hegel thought that he had come across, that his philosophy was the philosophy for all time. And it was a philosophy that said that truth is historically relative. Right? So everybody, that's contradictory. Because Hegel is saying that there's only truth within a historical circumstance, and yet his philosophy was the philosophy. He didn't realize that by teaching historical relativism, his own philosophy was being thrown into the garbage can of history, right? Because as soon as he's been dead for a generation, all ideas go into the garbage pit of history. He had a pupil, Hegel, Karl Marx, and Marx took this idea of historical relativism and applied it to economic life. And so that every religion, every philosophy, every worldview simply comes out of economic conditions. It's determined by the economic conditions. And so the philosophy of the mid-19th century, bourgeois, Western philosophy, was simply the product of the economic conditions of capitalism in 19th century Europe. Okay. Marx's philosophy came out of what conditions? Capitalist conditions of 19th century. Therefore, Marx's philosophy, according to his own theory, would be valid only in the middle of the 19th century in a capitalist society, and would be nothing more than the fruit of a capitalist society. Well, he didn't think that. He thought that Marxism was the absolute truth. Right? So he had a philosophy that says that all philosophies are determined by the historical economic conditions. Except one. Except Marxism. Right? And it's always that way. Every relativist is contradicting themselves because they're putting their relativism forward as a universal, absolutely true system. A system in which there are no absolute truths except that one. Okay, what's the antidote to all of this? Common sense. The recognition of these first principles that we mentioned at the beginning. It's so important. Everybody knows that they're true. They're not the patrimony of anyone. We've got them all in common. I don't have them any more than anybody else or any less than anyone else. And the greatest philosophers are the ones who defend these first principles. And they do a great service by defending them. And this is why the church puts forward St. Thomas Aquinas. He's not the only one. There are lots. But we call it the perennial philosophy of the human mind. Right? The perennial philosophy of the human mind is defending these first principles and building on them. And destruction of any society will come from attacking these principles and denying them. Right? So we can speak of a perennial philosophy, and one of the glories of the Catholic Church is that the Catholic Church has always defended all of these first principles. And has especially put forth as doctors of the church those men who most ably defended them and built them and made up an edifice raised up on them. I mean, we're called to do that today, each in our own way. So I've given you here at the end a summary of the arguments against relativism. Right? So the first point is all relativism contradicts itself. Everyone. Secondly, all relativism or skepticism is contrary to common sense. And that's, it would be like saying dreams or insanity are just as valid as waking and sane people. And third, relativism implies ultimately that the world's absurd. And yet, we know that the world's not absurd. Right, we experience it every day. And this is, especially the scientist. The scientist does science because he's got a conviction right from the start that he's going to find order out there. In everywhere we investigate. That's not going to be chaos. It's not going to be absurd. Even if he's an atheist, he's going to be convinced before he starts that the laws of gravity, the laws governing the stars are going to show a marvelous order. And therefore, the simplest and most beautiful explanation will be the true one. And that's reasonable. And then finally, moral consequences. Relativism, ultimately, is abominable. It's abominable because it leads to things that we all know are not simply false, but utterly contrary to human dignity. And so that's ultimately the best argument against relativism. There would be no criterion, ultimately, for condemning anything. How could you condemn Hitler or Nazism if there weren't first moral principles? So anyone who denies first moral principles, what are they doing? They're aiding and abetting people like Hitler. On that note, we'll...